So the deep conviction. And then in convictions, we need to discern between what is universal and what is personal. Now see, I think the Bible teaches certain universal convictions, biblical things, whereas there are a number of other convictions that I may adopt for myself, but I can't impose on you. For instance, I may adopt a certain style for my quiet time, but I can't impose it on you. But for me, it's a conviction that I need that. I may adopt certain ways that I live my life, which are not necessarily mandated biblically, but which I choose to do, but I can't mandate them to you. Now, what I can mandate, I can say there is a universal conviction that sexual immorality is wrong, because I can demonstrate that from Scripture. So I have a universal conviction that there is under no circumstances is it right. Do you see what I'm trying to say there? The difference between a universal conviction and a personal conviction. Now, the little diagram I put in shows how we develop our convictions. See, we study the Bible, then out of the Bible comes doctrine, and out of doctrine comes a set of beliefs. Or out of the Bible study comes some principles. Then the principles, we get ministry methods, conduct, and church structure, for instance. Then we might come out of study of the Bible, out and there come some direct commands, and we obey them. Notice that except for the direct commands, belief, ministry methods, conduct, and church structure are all twice removed from Bible. Largely interpretive. Which is kind of interesting. And that's why you've got so many denominations. See, we take things and we dissect them and then move them away from Scripture, and they're not necessarily direct application of the Bible. In many cases, they're permissible, but not directed. Now, what are the sources of your convictions? I think one source is your background. You grow up in a certain family, you grow up in the Navigators, and you come out of that with a set of convictions because of your background. Certain things are right and certain things are wrong. Then you've been taught certain things. Then we have peer pressure that force you to develop certain convictions. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." See, peer pressure does affect our decisions. The fourth source of conviction is we adopt convictions. You say, "Jerry, how are you? Are you pre-mill or post-mill?" And I can tell you. But I'll have to admit to you that I have not studied it as thoroughly as I could. But I have adopted convictions based on some other people's study, people whom I trust. And I've read and said, yeah, that really clicks with me. For one thing, I could spend my entire life trying to discern every area of doctrine and so forth. Now, I have studied the ones that I feel are most pertinent to my life. But I am going to adopt some convictions in some other areas. And I'm not embarrassed to do that, because there are godly men whose leadership I follow, whom I trust. Now, bit by bit, I trust that if I see a divergence between what they teach and what I've adopted and what the Bible teaches, well, I'll always go with what the Bible teaches. So there's danger in adoption, but I don't think there's any of us who doesn't do it. Really. The last one is just through the Bible and through the conscience, and it, of course, is the best, that we want to use that comment, combination of things. Okay, what's the process? Okay, let's suppose there's an area that I want to develop my convictions about. Okay, you name it. Okay, you identify that specific area. Let's suppose it's in the liberty area. Okay, and then the next thing I would do is to search out all the related biblical instruction that I can find on it. Everything that relates to the Bible teaching on that issue. You can write down the verses, copy them out, do whatever you want. I like to use a Vines dictionary as a real helpful one on getting some things like that. Then after I've had all of those and have studied on them, I want to pray over them and study them. Okay, then I think it's wise to ask some key questions, which I put on that sheet. And by the way, the source of that is Gene Ware. Gene gave me those questions, and I think they're very helpful in just trying to develop my conviction in a practical area. Then I believe, if it's a gray area particularly, I'd like to seek counsel and find out what some other godly men and women have come to conclusions on. Then I would like to make a decision on what I am going to have my convictions, begin to operate on that, but later I'd like to come back and evaluate that and say, well, now how is that working out in my life? And then lastly, I want to form habits. But see, in this whole business of ethics, I believe it all hinges on our commitment to first please God. That's that box down there at the bottom. I need to have an inner commitment of my heart that beyond anything else, I want to please God. And then I need my commitment to do what is right and a commitment to be obedient at all costs. Now, what I would like to leave you with is to use some of this as a basis for developing your thinking ethically on the job or in your personal life or in any situation that you may find yourself. There were several questions, for instance, that came up in the questions, well, is it right to do this or is it right to do that? Well, I can give you an opinion, but I can't tell you some of the things, whether it's right for you to do it. You have to be your own believer priest before God and make some decisions. Now, let's suppose you're functioning in the context of a group, i.e. Glen Erie, the LDI. I have no idea what you all have talked about in terms of personal guidelines of conduct. But I would imagine that there are some things that you've agreed on that said, while you're here in this environment, we agree to do certain things and to not do certain things. Great. Let's just do it, unless it violates your conscience. And I don't believe it will. See, I can always restrict myself to not do things that might be as little different from my personal conviction. Or you work for the navigators, and because of the testimony that you bear in terms of being identified with a Christian organization that has a certain reputation, you may restrict yourself and do something different than if you were just Joe Citizen. And we do it out of deference to our brothers and our sisters in Christ in a particular context. But in general in your life, I think these will give you some guidelines to start to make some ethical decisions. Now you notice I haven't given you bottom line answers because I think you need to investigate those yourself. I can't tell you how you're supposed to conduct your life in many of the gray areas. But I believe that if all of us sat down and started doing a good bit of Bible study on a particular issue, I would guess that the majority of us would come up with some similar directions. I don't think we would be highly divergent. But they're not the areas where I would feel comfortable mandating them on you, just simply because they may not be direct commands of Scripture. And certainly that's the case in the context of many areas of business ethics. I think I'd like to stop at this point and just see if you have some particular questions related to ethics and morality. Then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll finish off with questions and answers and perhaps a little synopsis of the vocational Christian work. But let's take some questions now in this. I pretty well plowed through this without giving much opportunity for questions. So, yes. No. Now the issue has to do with some of the doubt. Now that in the end of Romans 14, it says you do not want to do it with doubt until you've settled the issue of whether it is really wrong. Then you should probably refrain. But if you know that biblically, if once you settle the issue that biblically it's not a problem, then you have a choice of whether you'll do it or not. You may choose not to do it in deference for your parents or in deference for someone else, but you also have the freedom to do it And your conscience may still prick you because of your background, but at least know that you're not doing it in contrary to your, to the Bible. What you're doing it is in contrary, in contrast to your conscience, which is not necessarily what the Bible teaches.
I've heard teaching that your conscience is like a thermostat. You can set it pretty well wherever you want, and that you shouldn't transgress your conscience, but you should maybe set it like God said it differently, maybe think of it.
Well, that's a thought. Yeah, it's a concept that has some truth, and you can't do it very quickly, though. The conscience takes a long time to be reset to what are biblical standards, and I've had a lot of areas where I've just had to rethink it myself because of some of my background. And I don't think we should be glib about doing that, but I think we do need to make sure that we don't operate on a legalistic basis of life. I don't mind operating disciplined basis or a basis of deference to other people, but not on the basis of legalism. And I think there's a difference. I make free choices rather than someone else making choices for me.
You think it might be valid to work in an industry which might be doing immoral things, but being there for the purpose of being salt and light?
Generally not. It really depends on what you're defining as immoral things.
Part of their gray area. Like advertising just seems to be right now going downhill. Could you be a salt and light there? Some people don't like to patronize 7-Eleven because they sell pornography. My interpretation of unions is that they're mostly corrupt.
Yeah, I think you could. That in those limits, yes, I think the examples that you've given, I believe you could work in those environments. You might choose not to because you develop some conviction, not biblical conviction, but just a conviction that you don't want to be in a particular industry, that you'd rather you don't feel comfortable contributing to it. But I don't think there's hardly any industry that you can be in today where there is not some sense of some portion of it doing something that you probably would not agree with. I mean, even the cleanest of businesses regulated by government and all of that sort of thing are going to have corruption in them to some degree. And you, I think, should have an opportunity to counter it when you see it at some risk to your job, incidentally. Now, if there's something that they are doing that is clearly immoral, for instance, a true story of one of our NAV staff told me about. There's a friend that was a partner in a printing business. He had two other partners. He went out to the print shop one day and found them printing pornography, which was not only wrong morally, but it was wrong legally. He went to his other two partners and confronted them. They told him to shut up and not say anything about it, or he'd be in trouble. He had to get out of the business. He was caught, and he just had to quit and leave it. So he had to make some definite choices as to what he felt was a moral issue.
What about going on strike?
Going on strike, I think, has some... I don't like it, but I think there's probably some times when it's a possibility that one could strike. I've changed my view on that over the years as I've dealt with some laboring people and have dealt with the issue of strikes. In general, I would prefer not to. I do believe unions have a place. When I was a rather intellectual college student, I used to argue with my father, who was a member of the Teamsters, and so forth. But, you know, I have seen, you know, I realize that there needs to be checks and balances. The union is corrupt and business is corrupt. You know, I've watched how the company that my dad worked for, how it treated him. You know, wasn't exactly kindly. When he was 60 in his 60s, he had to do as hard work as the guys in their 20s. They didn't care how old he was. He had to produce the same amount and the whole business. There was very little concern for him, and the unions helped balance that out. The strike issue, I think, has to be judged on the merits of the strike, of whether or not it is justified. I personally would not strike just because the union said so. And I personally am opposed to using unions among professionals. An engineering union and other kinds. They're starting to develop. I'm trying to a great deal. The union movement is in a great deal of trouble today. They're losing membership rapidly. And you don't want the unions to go away, incidentally. I don't feel. I feel there always has to be checks and balances in a pagan system. So I'm not for losing them. I don't like some of the power they have. I think part of the inflation that we've had over the past years was caused by the unions being on a constant demand for extra wages. But so I'd be very cautious on the strike area. Some of you may remember the teacher strike here in Colorado Springs. When was that? 6 years ago? 5-6 years ago. But it was really rough. You know, the Christians in our own church were divided on the issues. There's another question. Yes. Yeah. Well, it depends on what it is. If it's an area of personal life, you're not bound to. If it's an area of performance in the context of job, you probably are. You know, how you are going to function in the context of a task. But you need to be convinced that the conviction is one that is for you, whether it be universal or not. You have to be convinced that it is universal. And I think it's fine to share our convictions with other people, because we sure don't want to just say, well, I don't really care what you do, and, you know, here's an idea. I think we need to share convictions, but we must be careful not to insist that everybody else adopt our particular convictions. So I think you have freedom. I think I'd listen. But just there being an authority has nothing to do with whether you adopt it. Yeah, you might. Until you have time to really think it through carefully. And if it's on a Christian society, I don't mind imposing Christian standards, particularly when they're moral standards that I feel are pretty basic, but I don't feel that we have the right to impose Christian belief. For one thing, it's impossible. You cannot do it. But I think we ought to have an influence on society. I think that Christians need to be involved in the political process. And that we ought to do all that we can to make... See, we know for a fact through history is that basic Christian principles have been a foundation of what we have done to a large extent. Not in every area, but to a large extent that has, you know, been a foundation stone for our country anyhow. And I feel that Christian principles ought to be followed in politics. I don't believe every... Just because a Christian is either pro-abortion or anti-abortion is quite the issue. I think we need to be very careful not to be one-issue people in politics. It's kind of like, do you want a Christian doctor or a competent doctor? You know, well, I think most of us would rather have a competent doctor. And there are Christians in politics who probably are incompetent in getting legislation through. Whereas there may be some non-Christians who really operate on good moral principles and do a good job in what's protecting of the government. So a person just being a Christian is not a sufficient reason, for instance, to vote for, because they may not be competent in what they do. Now, I think we ought to be involved in the process, but I don't think we can impose, a total morality on a non-Christian public. It doesn't work, for one thing. Prohibition is quite an example of that. And I'm glad to see people involved. I don't always agree, but, you know, I'm not going to sit and shoot at them. I'm sure not doing that much. And I say, well, let's let them have at it. And I'm just glad for some other influences. And I feel that it'll balance out as time comes on. Of course, it's been made a big issue in this election. Yeah, and that's right. And you can't impose, but I think we ought to influence all that we can. You know, if we have our beliefs, we have our families to be concerned about, the environment in which they live. And I think we need to recognize that our Constitution is not sacred. You know, the Constitution of the United States was not ordained by God. Now, I am a loyal citizen, but, you know, and I believe we ought to, we live in a constitutional state, and consequently we ought to function under it. But it's highly interpretive, and so, for instance, the appointing of Supreme Court justice. You put a justice in, and you know pretty well the way he's going to go on constitutional interpretation. And so I think we ought to influence the direction that as a group, or as an individual at least, that we feel will best serve the country. Be a lot of disagreement on that, but that's what we need. Well, let's... Oh, yeah, go ahead, Henry.
Can you give us a comparison, contrast definition of guilt and conscience, or conscience and guilt?
Okay, guilt and conscience. Well, guilt is a very good thing, because when you sin, you ought to be guilty. You ought to feel guilty, and you ought to have it. So guilt in and of itself is not a bad thing. The problem with it would be is after we've made confession that we need to allow that guilt to go away and be erased by God and to not continually disbelieve God, that he is saying, God, well, I realize you've forgiven me, but I still feel guilty. I think we need to get rid of that. Now, because then we are no longer guilty. But guilt is related to conscience. Conscience will stimulate guilt in our lives. And I guess you might say when conscience speaks about an issue, what it is doing is causing guilt about something we've done or said to surface in our lives. And we've got to do something about it. We've either got to say, we've got to take care of it, or we've got to say, well, my conscience is wrong, and it's a false guilt. And I think that can be there. A false guilt. Guilty about something that you have no need to be guilty about. So, they're closely related, Henry. Well, let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back together. And so you just need to realize that there are a lot of things in transition. But when it comes to speaking related to an organization, that is, as the navigators, we need to come to conclusions and a function on the basis of them, or else you can't function. You know, you have to be able to say, well, here's the way we're going to function, now that God may give us some more light later and we may develop and so forth, but we do have to make certain decisions. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about fulfillment. That question has come up, and I'll just give a brief summary. I believe that in the Western society, we have too high a focus on fulfillment, and that I do not believe that the Bible functionally teaches that the biggest thing, or even a very big issue in work, is that you are fulfilled. Now, I believe God wants us to be fulfilled in life. His purpose is that we will find fulfillment in all of life. And as I recall, let's see if I can find the passage in Colossians. Well, I don't see it initially. There were some passages that I had used in that path, and I'd rather than hunt it down now, that God wants us to be totally fulfilled in life. He wants us to be serving Him, to be happy, to be joyful. Okay, work is a part of that. So He doesn't want us to hate our work. But I'm not so sure that in the context of the way it is spoken of, that a job must fulfill my needs. For instance, I have data that says that most jobs are about 90% boredom and about 10% that is somewhat creative. There are a few rare jobs that are largely creative and where everybody just enjoys doing it. Now, one reason, just on a practical sense, that I have to say that we have an over-focus on this is that in the vast majority of the world, a person has very little choice as to what he does. And if a person even has a job, he is thankful. In most parts of India, just to have a job, whether it's in your field or not, is not even a question. Just that it provides for the food. Many times people go and just work in the business that their father was in. And so I think that because of our economy, which is so good, because of the freedom that we have in a Western society, not just in the United States, and the ability to change jobs and to not like this one and to go to another and to move from one part of the country to another, there is a very inward-looking quality that develops among us. That is, the highest good in life is that I am happy and that I feel good and that I get what I want. And that I find the perfect job that I'm going to enjoy for a lifetime. So biblically, I cannot justify it. Now you say, well, now Jerry, is it wrong to want to be at a job that you enjoy? No, it's not wrong. Is it wrong to change jobs? No. God's placed you in this society. You do live in a society where you can change jobs. But be careful of the motive. I do not believe the primary motive of getting into a job is for my fulfillment. For one thing, I don't think our fulfillment ought to be out of our work. It ought to be in God Himself. Now, how do you deal with the issue of not being fulfilled, of being bored? Well, I think we need to deal with it as to, are we where God wants us? Now, that's not an easy question to answer, I realize that. But there are many other factors other than fulfillment. In other words, do I really enjoy what I do? I also find that most jobs can be made enjoyable depending on our attitude toward it. That's not always true because there are some that are just very difficult and that it is very hard for us to really enjoy them. There are some people that for periods of time will do kinds of work that they don't enjoy at all. But you do it simply because this is the only thing you have to do at this point in time. I know people who have got college degrees and are operating on a professional basis, but they don't really enjoy what they're doing. They'd much rather be doing manual labor of some sort or another, using their hands. But they made a choice simply based on financial return. And they chose a job because it would provide for a better income. Instead of taking something that they'd probably have more fun at, but which pays less. So there are a lot of things that we need to balance in that regard. But the basic thing is let's not overemphasize fulfillment. Now, as supervisors, you need to provide job satisfaction. Now, I believe there are many factors in job satisfaction. Job satisfaction has to do not just with what you do, but who you do it with, why you do it, who you are working for, and what the end result of the work is. What is the product? For instance, I see it very easily where a person could be a key punch operator at Glen Eyrie and have more of a sense of satisfaction than having it at Interstate Gas, simply because they have a sense that they are contributing to something that they really believe in deeply. Now, as you know, I have already said that in terms of the job, I don't think there's any higher value doing that for the navigators as doing it for Colorado Interstate Gas. Make another comment just in this whole business of what is a ministry. Work is ministry. But if I come to Glen Eyrie and work as a secretary 40 hours a week, essentially, and then compare that to working as a secretary 40 hours a week for some secular firm, I have a difficult time saying that my commitment to ministry is fulfilled by my work now where it wasn't before. See, I still have a responsibility, just as any layman, as any person, to have some outreach, to be involved with people, to be a responsible member of your church, to function as a Christian. And I've had some discussions with people at various points, thinking, well, now I'm coming here to work in an administrative task, so now my job is my ministry. Well, that is only true insofar as, yes, it is that portion of ministry which is substituting for what you were doing when you were in the field, where you were in a field ministry. But it is no more ministry than when you were working in a secular job doing the same thing, if you see what I mean. Because I don't think God values it that much more. That is what you are doing. Now, the direction of an organization or a ministry as a total, yes, it has a greater contribution there. I still have a responsibility just as I did when I taught at the Air Force Academy to have some ministry. Now, I may have a different kind, but yet I still feel the responsibility personally and biblically. That's just some thoughts on perspective in that regard. Are there some other thoughts on fulfillment that you'd like to ask? Carla, does that help on... I know you asked some about that. Okay? Okay, let me go to a couple of questions. I ran into a number of questions that came in here on the issue of overtime. And it has to do with the issue of servanthood versus working overtime. And several questions were in there. Well, now, am I obligated? And is it bad? When can I say no? And should my job totally consume me, etc.? Now, I realize I'm walking on the edge of a cliff here. But the fact is that if you were to work for the Navigators, and the Navigators demanded 60 to 70 hours a week of you all the time, constantly, such that there was nothing else you could do, I would treat it in the same way that I would working for Boeing. I said, now it is restricting my health. It is restricting my ability to minister outwardly in some way. And it is draining me emotionally. So you have to treat it in the same way. I don't think that it should be a consistent, constant thing, that we're always having to put in overtime. Now, when do you? Well, when there's a need. I think when there are some needs. Now, if the needs are constant, then we're going to have to, as a group of supervisors, address the staffing and manning of what we do, or cut down the services, one or the other. Now, I do believe in a training situation, you do need to learn how to serve. And for historically through the years, part of serving at Glen Eyrie has been the issue of servanthood, flexibility, and being able to kind of go the second mile in terms of what you are due and your availability. So learn what you can from that. But that's related mostly to the LDI. For those of you who are working in regular, administrative, secretarial, whatever kinds of jobs, NAP press, whatever it is, I think you need to guard having excessive overtime, because it's going to have the same impact to you on you as doing excessive overtime in other places. Yes?
Well, I think in relation to Glen Eyrie, how do you handle it when people work 8 to 5 and they putter around and they don't give themselves totally to the job, and they grumble about not having the rooms clean, and they have to stay 30 minutes over and clean them, but then they didn't give themselves, and they had the regular lot of time to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now that I would confront very definitely. I would confront on the basis of laziness and lack of diligence, and pretty directly. I really would, because I think we're responsible there to do the job that we're expected to do, and do it well and wholeheartedly, and to learn to work better. I think one of the great things of Glen Eyrie is learning how to work. Many, many people today come from homes where they did not learn how to work and to work hard. I was very fortunate, and the fellow that influenced me to come to know Christ was a businessman for whom I worked. And I worked for him for several years during high school and later. And boy, I'll tell you, I learned how to work. I mean, he was a taskmaster. And he did not let me get away with things. And I think one of the problems in the Christian environment is we let people get away with things. And we accept slothfulness when we ought not to. And I feel pretty strongly that we ought to confront it if it's there, and to handle it. I mean, it's just only right that we do that. We're not serving people if we don't give that kind of training and development. And I think we let's be careful we don't cross over into this nitpicky business. I'm talking about the actual issue of a person not working well. See, many people don't know how to work well. You know, they've not learned how to give 100% to what they're doing at a particular point in time. And that needs to be learned, even at the cost of a bit of conflict, because that's part of character development. And I hope we're still working on character in the Navigators. That would be very comforting to me if we were. be very discomforting if we weren't. Would you like to address something more on the issue of overtime?
Yeah. For a salaried person, I guess I don't see anything magical about a 40-hour week.
No, I don't think there is.
And I just sometimes wonder how to balance how much time to spend at work or doing work at home versus family demands and church mm-hmm. demands.
Well, personally, see, for the salaried person, functionally you're paid for a... most people and most salaries in this situation are paid for a functional 40-hour week. Okay, when do you do other? You do other when there's specific needs that require, or where you trade off some time. Or you may want to do some more work when you know you haven't been all that productive. You know, there are a lot of things, and you want to do it. I do believe there's a little bit of a difference in how we treat our function when a person is salaried and when a person is hourly paid. And this is not biblical, but this is just practical. A salaried person is usually paid for a particular type of function and is given a responsibility for sets of tasks to be accomplished and given quite a bit of freedom on how it's accomplished. And he operates much more on a bottom line, that is, was the task done? Was it done right? Was it done on time? And was the proper amount of it done? Less on whether, on how he did it and the timing involved in it. Whereas most hourly paid jobs are related directly to tasks that require primarily time. See? To do it. And if you put in an hour less, there is an hour's less of functioning, quote, I guess you'd call production. That's involved. So there's a responsibility in that regard that's slightly different. Now the problem comes in between salaried and hourly paid in terms of the various freedoms that they have. And that can be a tension. I understand that. And I think those who are salaried need to make sure, and I don't know how you're functioning over in the administrative areas or in NAB Press, but we need to make sure that we don't abuse some of the privileges that we have in terms of just being pretty free. And I think we need to be responsible for getting the work done and putting in an acceptable amount of time. So I don't know whether that helps, Carl, but it just, you know, I think you should put limits. I try to put some limits on myself and say, okay, functionally, I don't want to work more than X amount over a long period of time. And then respond to the needs as they come up. If there's a push, well, then we just need to kind of get with it and work whatever amount of time. You know, it's like when our International Navigator Council comes up in January, all of us in international headquarters are probably going to put in a lot of extra time in preparation for it. But we have some freedom later to not put in perhaps as much time. Okay, some other thoughts are in any of those areas related to overtime. I don't know whether I've addressed the Glen Eyrie situation all that much. Okay, here's another question. And please just, whether I stop or not, raise your hand with the question. After leaving the LDI, I intend to go back into my professional career and hope to get involved in a community ministry. I hope to find a job that pays well enough to support my family and for us to have a nice home. It is not my major goal in life, but just a desire to provide well materially for my family. Is this okay? Yes. It is no problem at all, as far as I'm concerned. If God has given you a skill that's able to get a job that has an appropriate salary that you're able to do certain things, that's fine, as long as you don't become materially focused, as long as you are faithful with the money that God gives you, instead of buying, you know, two new cars, that you consider giving, that it becomes a significant portion of your thinking, that is, and that you set some limits probably on your lifestyle. It again goes back into the motive as to what you do with what God gives you. Here's just one. Is it refusing to work extra on the spur of the moment, being inflexible, or letting your supervisor know the limits? Well, it could be inflexible if you never would. But I know that I would always want, as a supervisor, if a person had something, I'd feel very badly if they didn't tell me that they had a plan. You know, and if all they did is every time I asked just to say, oh yeah, well, then what I would do, I'd stop, I'd really be very cautious about ever asking. But if you got something which is, you cannot do it or you should not do it, I'd tell them. Let your supervisor know some of the limits. I think you need to do that because he doesn't know your limits, or she. How are they going to know if you don't say something? They may just think you're a person of infinite capacity. And the fact is, just with, you know, with my secretary Margie, I don't always know how long she works, you know, or how much. And so I might just assume, well, everything's okay and you just keep going, and she might just be working herself into the ground and I'm not aware of it because I travel and so forth. So somehow there's got to be communication in the process on that. Oh my, there's so many good questions here. This is an interesting one. If it is it biblical to define an organization's and department's purpose and goals and how to achieve these? If so, what does the Bible say about this? Basically, is it biblical to plan, organize, and manage our work? I think there have been a couple, three good books written on this, but let me give something brief. I believe one of the basic commands is that we are to do things decently and in order. We have the pattern in Acts, for instance, when the apostles were being badgered by the widows of the Greeks, and they said, we've got to figure out some organization to handle this, and they figured out, oh, here's how we'll do it. We'll appoint deacons, and the deacons will do this, and then we'll do that. And they had very clear set up objectives as to what would happen and how they would do it and why. And I think you find patterns throughout the Scripture that planning, organizing, and managing was very much there. Certainly it's there in the Old Testament. The entire book of Nehemiah is one of organization and planning. The entire operation of getting the children of Israel out of Egypt is planning. There was a system of how everybody functioned when the cloud lifted. Everybody knew what they were to do and how they were to move out. And it was in order. They had bands of these and so many of this. And then Moses came down. And Moses was chewed out because he didn't organize properly. And Jethro, his father-in-law, says, you know, what you're doing is wrong. You're going to wear yourself out and it's going to go to pieces. You've got to select men from among you and give them certain tasks. So I think it's very biblical to plan, organize, and manage. Now we can do it in an unbiblical and unchristian manner. But I think it's very biblical to do it. And so, in fact, I think it's being a good steward. It fits into the whole idea of being a good steward of one's time. I'm not going to every one on each sheet here. I've tried to star some. Here's one question of someone who has having to, the topic of working at two jobs to make ends meet. That can't be done for a long time. It's just too much pressure. And I think when the job is not meeting the needs financially, you only have two choices. One is to cut back as to the needs, which, you know, there is a basic minimum. And the other is to find something which does meet the needs, that has adequate remuneration so that you can do it. I don't know of any other two things. I don't think a person, if they're going to have a decent family life in ministry, how they are going to continue operating. You do it for short periods of time. You know, you go through school or you have some specific goals, and here again, you do things for a couple of years and you by agreement between husband and wife, for instance, and I think that's fine, but not over the long haul. Another question on this sheet was said, in Friends and Friendship, you speak of need of Christians to be socially involved with unbelievers in order to avoid stagnation in our own Christian lives, so that we might be salt and light in the world. My wife and I agree with this, but what about Christian friends that are dear to us who disagree? We have some friends who have isolated themselves from the world. They're very upfront in telling us how they feel about communicating with the world. How do we express to them in love and without sounding judgmental our feelings to the contrary without threatening the relationship? First of all, I don't think it's possible to do that without threatening the relationship. But if the relationship does not perceive the need to reach the world, then it's worth threatening the relationship. And those whom we would draw in as our closest friends are certainly going, that is, of Christian friends, are almost always going to be those who would have a similar perspective in the area of reaching out to the world. If not, I don't think we would have necessarily that much fellowship. And so we would need to have some agreement in that regard. And I would risk losing the Christian friends and who don't have that perspective or who are holding on to the relationship so tightly that you can't reach out to others. And I would just risk the friendship and put it to the test and reach out to non-Christians. Is it possible to like our job so much that it can become harmful to us? By all means, it can become your God. In fact, it's possible for the navigators to replace God in your life. And our whole self-image and self-respect can be built up in the navigators such that if you weren't with the navigators or some Christian organization, that you would feel that you'd failed in life. And that's a real danger. That's a real danger to get all your self image out of any job or any organization because it takes it away from God himself. And I believe our source must be God, not a job or a career. That has to do a little bit with fulfillment again. Okay, how can secretaries assume more responsibility and better remuneration for their services without appearing to be too aggressive? That's a very tough one. Now, I believe in the non-Christian context, it's easier than in a Christian context. I believe that, first of all, in the Christian context, if there is a problem in the area of unequal remuneration, that somebody needs to be willing to address it, at least surface the issue. Secondly, the business of assuming more responsibility is a difficult one. For every job has certain limitations on its responsibilities. It has a span. But it's especially in a job that is most primarily a serving job, that there are some limits. And it is highly dependent on the person for whom you work. Last night, I believe I'm trying to think of the source where I read this. Yes, I remember. I read a little note somewhere in a little magazine, I don't even know what the name of the magazine was, of a study about secretaries and their relationship to executives particularly. The survey among executives was that, in fact, most executives do not consider their secretaries to be secretaries. They consider them to be their assistants. They consider them to be really almost a junior executive working alongside them because that is virtually the way they end up functioning. And so I have found that a good bit of responsibility can be given, but it is strictly a result of how that relationship develops and whether there is a mutual sharing of some of those authorities. And of course, then you've got to be careful because others outside your direct work environment may not recognize that person's ability or authority to say or do something. So I think being a good secretary takes a great deal of wisdom in that regard to be able to handle that. She may know that she makes a lot of decisions, but others may not know it as to what she's able to do. And really a great deal of authority and power. One other question here was, is there some way that single women can be included in more of the social and educational aspects of the NAV work? Yes, there is. But one of the problems is we're not very big on social anything in the NAV work. And that at least that's my observation being here. The whole social environment at Glen Eyrie and through all of our things is quite segmented. And that's part of an issue, by the way, that's both good and bad. The good part is many people, if you're going to focus outwardly, in any kind of ministry, you can't spend all your time focusing inwardly, which is a frustration to some, and I don't know how to answer that. But the fact of single women being included, I think that is a weakness, because couples tend to relate to couples, and that's just a good thought that we need to give some thinking to that. Okay. Oh, this is a good one. There are a lot of good ones. But one is, said, Jerry, you have tremendous capacity to effectively accomplish a lot of projects. Is this capacity part of your God-given makeup? Is it the result of learned self-discipline or both? Primarily, as far as I can determine, it's part of your God-given makeup. That's where the basic issue of capacity comes from. And it is developed over a period of years. It relates a lot to one's personality. But one can have great capacity and still not focus it on the right tasks. So there is a self-discipline of whatever capacity you have. And the less capacity you have emotionally and physically, the more you must discipline where you put it. And I also believe, as I told you earlier, that capacity can be developed. Yes.
You said that for some of your gifts and all, you really didn't realize them until you were
30. Mm-hmm.
How did you go about doing that?
It's mostly, I'm very practical in the area of gifts. I've taken a number of tests, and they give me a little indication. But frankly, it's by seeing what the results are. I cannot discern what a gift is until you see the results. For instance, if someone has a result of a gift of administration, you see it by how they handle things. And if someone has a gift of leadership, I think you can't see it until you see some people responding to their leadership. A person who has a gift of teaching is particularly difficult to discern early. I mean, really spiritual teaching, because they don't often get the opportunity to teach when they're younger in any significant way. I really believe you have to test the waters, and I believe some experimentation is the best way to know, unless you just happen to have a sense of it internally. I think the fear barometer is pretty good. I mean, when you start doing some things and you just can't handle it and can't stand it and you just go berserk on it, well, I doubt if that's your gift. You know, someone was asking me the other day how to, you know, on the issue of speaking, and do you ever get over a fear of speaking? And, well, probably that person is not going to be one who is going to be a heavy communicator and teacher in a public sense. There are several aspects of the gifts of teaching, by the way, and private teaching is also effective. Same with evangelism and so forth. I believe we'll see it by the fruit. It says, by your fruits you shall know them. That's a little bit out of context, but I feel that, you know, it says what happens in your life is you'll see that as a result. So that's the way I view the gifts. I don't think tests are going to do it. Now, I don't think tests are bad. There are several tests on gifts, but the tests are on your experience. If you'll notice, many of them, if you were doing such and such, you know, would you run over a cat or would you hit the child or something like that, you know. You know, a little choice, and you think, well, then let's see, what have I done in the past? And so that's a little silly. Sorry about that. You need some levity at this time. But they all base on your experience of what you have done. Art Miller, who has done a great deal on motivational things in the job, all of his business is on what you've done. It's all experiential. So that's why I would say, look at what you've done. And that's why it takes a little longer to find out. I think it's particularly difficult to discern leadership early. That's going to really last, because there's so much more that has to go with it. Okay, let me just... let me give you one here on what are guidelines for witnessing at work. Don't do it on the employer's time. It's the basic guideline I give you. There's a lot of ways to do it. You can meet with people for lunch. You can see them for a bit of coffee break. You can arrange to see them after work. But, you know, you can say a word or two. But don't get into those long philosophical discussions at work. I just don't think it's the right place. It'll backfire on you eventually, I guarantee it.
We
that's more appropriate for another time, because Navigators is an organization that
requires stewardship. Yes, it really depends. There's a certain amount of counseling. It depends on your job description, Julie. If your job description involves supervising somebody, then I think you have to say, well, I have several levels of responsibility to that individual. But when it's just someone else in another department that you are going to help, I think you need to, again, we need to guard our time just a bit. And it relates to what is your task. If you have some question, talk to your boss. Say, listen, you know, I have thus and such a situation. What would you like me to do? That's why being under authority is good. It's like taking vacation, taking days off. Many times you need a boss who will tell you to do it. And so otherwise you feel guilty about it. So. Okay, some of these are pretty complex. I've already answered the one, and how do you see going into full-time spiritual work after immediately completing your studies? I see it as risky. Now, if you are directly going with a mission organization overseas, to some degree that's not bad, depending on what task you're going into. But in general, I like to see people have some other responsibilities first. How do you know if you're becoming a workaholic? By the number of hours you stay overtime, or is it an attitude? I think it's both. I think the number of hours you work, I've never seen a workaholic who works only 40 hours a week. You know, it's usually when it gets up to regularly 60 and 70 and taking stuff home and always having it on your mind and never being able to turn it off. And your attitude toward it, I think the biggest danger is, number one, when it hinders your family and your marriage relationship, it prevents you from having other relationships, and when it starts to be the thing that is more important to you than God himself, than your relationship to him. When it starts to replace God in your life, and that's a bit subtle, but it does happen, I believe. Yes.
Can a workaholic be a person that not necessarily just in their regular 40-hour week job, but gets caught up in, you know, taking care of the house and doing things?
Sure. Yeah, a workaholic, you don't... The thing is, if you have tasks that just totally consume you, such that you lose your relationships, you start hurting your health, and you neglect your family, and so forth, those would be the things that would start to be danger sign. Ted Engstrom, is it Ted Engstrom? Or Ed Dayton and Ted Engstrom, maybe it is, did a book on the workaholic and his family. And it's a good one. And if you have some thoughts on it, it ought to be done. I think I adequately answered the job on secular versus full-time work. I was pretty strong on that, so... There were some questions in here on being evaluated. I would really like to encourage supervisors, and I'm sure there are some of you here, to at least every 6 months to give people a progress review on what they're doing and how they're doing it. They really need it. And it must be more frequently than every year. So every 6 months, I believe that needs to be done. And it should be a progress review, not an evaluation. That is, you know, what are they trying to do, and what are some of their goals, and what are some of their frustrations? How can I help you do your job better? You're asking as a supervisor. Is there anything you'd like to tell me?